I have learned that disappearances do not begin with chaos. They begin with routine, with decisions so ordinary they feel invisible when you replay them later. And this one began with a quiet stretch of road that locals drove every day without thinking twice about it. I reviewed the call logs and the weather that morning, and nothing stood out. Not the sky, not the temperature, not the hour. The road ran straight and open, bordered by fields and trees, and the people who lived nearby would later tell us they noticed nothing unusual. No screams, no struggle, no sound worth remembering. When a runner fails to return, the first hours are often filled with reasonable explanations. But I have also learned that the absence of evidence can be its own signal when it lingers too long. I read the first missing person report after the search had already begun, and even then the name had not yet settled into the weight it would later carry. By the end of that day, the runner was no longer just a jogger on a rural road. She was Sydney Sutherland. I first encountered Sydney Sutherland through photographs attached to the case file, the kind taken casually and not meant to be evidence, and they showed a young woman who looked comfortable in her own routines. She was 19 years old, living in Elkins, Arkansas, and balancing work with plans that had not yet hardened into something specific. When I reviewed statements from family and friends, the descriptions were consistent, steady, and unembellished, which often tells me more than dramatic language ever could. Running was part of her daily rhythm. It was not treated as a risk by anyone who knew her, because the roads she used were familiar and the distances predictable. The route she favored followed a rural stretch near her home, where traffic was light and faces were recognizable. According to phone records and witness accounts, this was not an impulsive choice that morning. It was a continuation of something she had done many times before. I confirmed through interviews that Sydney typically ran alone, often with her phone and headphones. That detail mattered later, not because it was unusual, but because it shaped how much interaction she would have had with her surroundings. People remembered seeing her jog past before, but few could place an exact date or time, until that day demanded it. Familiarity tends to dull urgency. On the morning of August 19, 2020, Sydney left home, wearing running clothes, and did not tell anyone she was changing her route. There was no indication of distress or conflict before she left. Her vehicle remained at home, and there were no messages suggesting she planned to meet someone. These are the small certainties we lean on early, because they narrow what can be responsibly said. Her absence was noticed when she failed to return. Family members attempted to reach her by phone, and those attempts went unanswered. When I reviewed the timeline, I noted how quickly concern replaced assumption. This was not a delayed response shaped by complacency. It was measured, but it was prompt. Local law enforcement was contacted, and a search began that same day. Deputies canvassed the area along her known route, checking ditches, tree lines, and fields. Volunteers joined in, many of them people who recognized her name and face without needing an introduction. Rural communities compress distance in that way. Everyone knows someone who knows you. I reviewed the early search notes, and they were thorough but restrained. There was no sign of a struggle along the road, no discarded clothing, no obvious evidence pointing in a specific direction. That absence complicated the next steps, because when nothing is out of place, everything remains possible. Helicopters were requested, and search dogs were deployed. The terrain beyond the road widened into wooded areas and public land, which expanded the search radius significantly. I confirmed through official logs that weather conditions did not impede visibility, which ruled out several early assumptions. As the day wore on, the case shifted from a missing runner to a potential abduction. That transition is never announced aloud, but it is understood in how resources are reassigned and how questions change. I saw that shift in the way interviews were documented, with greater emphasis placed on vehicles seen along the route. Residents were asked about unfamiliar cars, slow-moving trucks, or anyone parked where they did not belong. The answers varied, and most were inconclusive, but one detail surfaced more than once. A vehicle described as a red pickup truck had been noticed in the area around the time Sydney was believed to be running. At that stage, the description meant very little. Red pickup trucks are common in Washington County, and no license plate was attached to the observation. Still, it was logged, because patterns often begin as fragments. By the end of the first day, Sidney had not been found. I reviewed the press releases issued that evening, and they were careful, asking for information without implying wrongdoing. That tone is intentional. It preserves credibility while allowing facts to surface. What stood out to me, even then, was how ordinary the day had been until it wasn't. Nothing in the records suggested that Sidney had anticipated danger. The road had not changed. The routine had not changed. The only variable, as we would later confirm, was the presence of someone who did not belong in that routine at all. The second day of the search began with expanded resources and a narrowing focus. I reviewed overnight developments before briefing with other investigators, and the working theory had solidified around an abduction from the roadside. That conclusion was based not on speculation, but on the continued absence of physical evidence where Sidney had last been seen. Surveillance footage from nearby properties and traffic cameras was collected and reviewed. The footage did not capture the abduction itself, but it did help establish vehicle movement patterns along the route during the relevant window. That process takes time, and I noted how each camera's coverage ended just short of certainty. Witness interviews continued, and the red pickup truck resurfaced. This time it was connected to a specific individual known within the community. I reviewed employment records and confirmed that the man associated with the truck lived nearby and worked at a poultry processing plant. His name was Quake Llewellyn. I want to be precise about what we knew and when we knew it. At that point, Llewellyn was not a suspect in name, but he was identified as someone whose vehicle matched prior descriptions. He was also someone who would have been familiar with the area and with Sidney herself. That familiarity would later become critical. When Llewellyn was interviewed, his statements were compared against verified timelines. He acknowledged seeing Sidney that morning while driving his truck. That admission shifted the case decisively. Seeing her placed him within proximity, and proximity invites scrutiny. I reviewed the recorded interview footage, and what stood out was not emotion, but inconsistency. His account of events changed when compared to objective data. Cell phone records contradicted parts of his timeline, and physical evidence would soon deepen that gap. Search efforts were redirected to public land within driving distance of the route. On August 21, 2020, searchers located Sidney's body in the McIroy Wildlife Management Area. I reviewed the discovery report, and it was clear that the location had been deliberately chosen for concealment. The cause of death was later determined to be blunt force trauma. That finding was supported by the medical examiner's report, which I read in full. There was no ambiguity in the conclusion, and it aligned with physical evidence recovered during the investigation. Evidence collected from Llewellyn's vehicle included trace material that linked him directly to Sidney. That linkage was established through forensic analysis, not assumption. When I reviewed those results, the case moved from circumstantial to evidentiary. Confronted with the accumulating evidence, Llewellyn confessed. His confession included details that had not been publicly released, which further corroborated its validity. He admitted to abducting Sidney from the roadside and transporting her to the location where her body was found. I am careful with the word confession because it carries weight. In this case, it was supported by physical evidence, witness statements, and forensic findings. It was not the sole pillar of the case. It was one component in a structure already standing. Throughout this phase, the investigation remained grounded in documentation. Every movement, every statement, every transfer of evidence was logged. That discipline is what allows facts to remain intact long after emotion fades. The tape does not show the moment itself. There is no footage of the abduction. What exists instead is a sequence of verified events that leave no space for reasonable doubt. That absence of a single defining image often leads people to imagine one, but imagination is not evidence, and we did not need it. By the time the arrest was formally announced, the community already sensed the outcome. Familiarity had become betrayal, and routine had been weaponized. Those realizations did not come from commentary. They came from confirmed actions, documented and reviewed. The legal process that followed was direct. I reviewed the charging documents, which outlined capital murder and related offenses. The charges reflected the severity of the crime and the strength of the evidence supporting them. There was no reliance on circumstantial inference alone. Court proceedings moved forward, and pretrial motions were addressed in accordance with state law. I monitored those developments through official filings rather than commentary, because the record is where outcomes are decided, not in public reaction. In 2022, Quake Llewellyn was convicted of capital murder. The conviction carried a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. I verified the sentencing order and confirmed that it reflected the jury's decision, not a negotiated reduction. There were no unresolved evidentiary gaps at the conclusion of the case. The physical evidence, the confession, and the forensic analysis aligned consistently. Appeals were anticipated, as they often are, but the foundation of the case remained intact. Sidney Sutherland's death did not remain an open question. It was answered within the limits of what evidence can responsibly establish. The investigation identified who committed the crime, how it occurred, and where it ended. It did not speculate beyond that. I reviewed the final case summary before it was archived, and what struck me was not a dramatic conclusion, but a complete one. There were no dangling leads, no unidentified vehicles, no missing hours left unexplained. That completeness matters, even when the outcome cannot be undone. What remains now is documentation, reports, transcripts, evidence logs, and a sentence that will be carried out through time rather than action. Those are the tools we have once a case leaves the field and enters record. Sidney Sutherland is not defined by how her life ended, but this record exists because it did. The facts do not soften with repetition, and they do not sharpen with retelling. They remain what they were when first confirmed. The road where she ran is still there. The fields still border it. People still pass through without noticing anything out of place. That continuity is not symbolic. It is simply factual. The case is closed,